Yeah, there's, it's going.
Okay, great. Then I'm going to talk loud enough so that the device picks it up, hopefully, and if you can't hear me, raise your hand. That's not logical. But we are going to talk about logic today, and I have to first of all say that technically speaking, this is a summer rerun, even though it's not summer yet. Jim is right. The project I'm going to tell you about goes back a long way. It really started in early discussion early in the 1990s, and the first foray into this really was an effort by Matt Leese, a then computer science undergraduate, to do a kind of a prototype of an idea we had of somehow finding some real clinical application of this wonderful creation of Jim and Cornelius Ross and Onard Mahino and Augusto Agencio and a number of other people over the years to build a logical model of anatomical structure as opposed to just pictures and descriptions. And it's that logic that really has power. It's unreasonable how much power logic has, but I'm a theoretical physicist and I've gotten used to it. So these large logic structures that describe things, biological entities or medical entities and their relationships are generally called ontologies. And so the foundational model of anatomy is an example of an ontology, one of the best examples. And I'm going to talk about how we can use that ontology and augment it with a little bit about probability and probabilistic reasoning to come up with what I think eventually could be a useful clinical predictive model for how tumors spread around the body, at least in the regional areas around the primary tumor, and why that's important in terms of radiation therapy for cancer. So, first I want to say, I've already mentioned Cornelius and Jim and Onard. Oh, I don't have Augusto up there. I mentioned Matt Leese, but there are a number of other people who've contributed over the years from all over the University of Washington and even as far away as, well, that's further down the slide. We've had contributors internationally as well. So when we thought of doing an application of anatomy ideas and radiation therapy planning, we started with the head and neck region because that's a really complex area of the body. And also it's an area where radiation treatment has to be finely tuned to really hit the target and not hit anything else. There's a lot of other things in the way. So we had involvement not only from radiation oncologists, but from, for example, Mark Whipple in otolaryngology, head and neck surgery. So what I'm going to talk about is the significance of this project in the context of biomedical informatics and biology and medicine. I'll give you a little background on radiation therapy planning so that you know what that's about. You'll see it's pretty intuitive. Eventually, we hope to integrate the model into an actual radiation therapy planning system that is usable in clinical practice, and there are such things. So people have been using radiation therapy planning computer modeling for about, at this point, 50 years. Goes back to the early 1960s. The PRISM project is the latest of our efforts over the 30 some odd years I've been here. We've actually built three generations of these simulation systems, and I'll say a little bit about that. And then the actual clinical target volume model, and then I hope we'll have some time to talk about where it's going to go. So the project itself has not been active recently. That's why I said this is kind of like a TV rerun. The last work really was done in 2006 or 2007 or so, and it's because I've been busy doing other things. And I have some hope now of reviving the project, getting it moving again. And so if this is something that people are interested in pursuing, I'll stir a little interest and we can talk about how to carry it forward. So to put it in context, as I think all of you know, there's this huge transformation of biology and medicine now. Mostly people think of it in terms of an explosion of data, that we have just enormous gobs of data, terabytes of data, image data, clinical data, molecular biology, sequence data, and gene activity and protein interaction data, all kinds of stuff. And then there's going to be this question of how to organize it. And at the next level up, people are organizing this stuff into chunks of knowledge as well. And the fact that we have many, many small bits of knowledge that we have to organize in some systematic way, this is really the challenge of biomedical informatics. And so the next, so the biggest right now is in molecular biology and cellular biology, but the next big massive change is going to be with clinical data, because everybody is now implementing electronic medical record systems per the mandate of the federal government, and hundreds of billions of dollars are being spent on this. So it's no small enterprise, and there's going to be huge amounts of clinical data, not from clinical trials, but just in the ordinary course of treatment. And we're going to have to figure out how are we going to leverage that to learn something about what's going on with health and disease. So there's three possible ways I could think of, and there may be more, that we might handle this challenge. One is the idea of organizing the data and knowledge, giving it labels, giving it structure, and making it widely accessible and enabling integration of disparate data sources and disparate knowledge sources. And roughly speaking, you can say this is what the semantic web is about. Although the term semantic web can be argued a lot, so I don't want to open a big can of worms, but it's kind of in that general direction. Another thing that's a very important and large activity is the idea of searching the data for patterns, that is knowledge discovery, sometimes also called data mining. And this is essentially an application of statistical modeling, data fitting, but it has connections and roots with a branch of computer science called machine learning. They're kind of related, and the computer scientists have their set of jargon about how do they describe such things, and statisticians have a different set of jargon, but they're talking ultimately about the same thing. We have an enormous amount of data. What can we learn from it by looking for patterns? And so this is another big area of activity. And I'm not very involved in either of those. There's a third area of activity which is much smaller, but which I think is going to grow in the future. And that was the area that I jumped into many years ago. And that is to try to construct theories. That's because I'm a theoretical physicist. It's what I do. I'm the hammer that's looking for the nail, right? And I think that's natural. If you're a hammer, it would be really, really a bad idea to try to tighten or loosen bolts. Get damaged that way. So I'm sticking with what I know. I'm trying to build theories. Now, the difference between biology and medicine on the one hand and physics on the other hand is that in physics we have probably 400 years worth of experience with building theories, and by and large the kinds of theories people build in the realm of physics are mathematical theories involving continuous functions and differential equations, and write down the equations and we try to solve them and then we find out how it all works. In biology and medicine, things don't work quite that way. We don't have continuous variables with which you can write down differential equations for, except in a few cases. Or if we do, there's so many billions of equations that it's an intractable kind of way of doing things. And so instead, the kinds of computational theories or theories that can be built right now in biology are really more logic-based theories in which we're still creating some model with principles and relationships and general statements from which you then can infer a lot of stuff. It's like solving the equations, but they're going to be logic-based theories and network-based theories rather than the kind of classical physics way of thinking. So I want to say a little bit about radiation therapy, as I mentioned. So here is a faculty member posing as a patient. And this is a real radiation therapist who agreed to pose for the picture. And this is a real radiation therapy machine in use in the radiation therapy clinic down the hall in UW Medical Center. So the machine has in it an X-ray generator, which generates X-rays on the order of energy up to some 20 million electron volts. That's a fair amount of energy. That's not exactly the big atom smashers at CERN, but it's a, a sizable amount of energy of radiation, and it's pretty penetrating when it comes to tissue. The X-rays can come out this aperture here, but also the way the X-rays are generated is through an electron gun. The electrons actually are accelerated to the same energy, and then they hit a heavy metal target. It doesn't make music, it makes X-rays. So the electron beam itself can be extracted out instead of putting the target in the way you pull the target out. Now, when you have the target in, almost all of the electron's energy goes into the target and generates heat. There's actually water cooling piped through in that head. So when you pull the target out, if you were to just bring the electron beam out, you'd kill somebody. So the electron beam has to get turned down about a factor of 100 or 500 in intensity in that case. And if you had been reading about the history of radiation treatment for cancer, and you'd run across stories about radiation machinery that went awry and killed people because of excess radiation dose, what happened was the machine had a design flaw in which the target could be moved out and the electron beam would not be turned down automatically, and so the patient got the full electron beam, and that caused almost immediate serious problems and deaths in about 3 or 4 cases. So that's kind of a brief history of radiation therapy. In the early days, we didn't have such powerful machines, and radiation therapy wasn't very effective. Since the early 1980s, we've had machines that have penetrating power to be able to put a lot of energy into deep tumors and not deposit much energy on the way in to the skin or other soft tissue. And by aiming from different directions and combining those different radiation beams, you can really effectively destroy tumors without doing permanent damage to the surroundings. But the whole trick is figuring out where's the target, how to aim the radiation beams, how much from the front, how much from the back, how much from odd angles, and what's the best angle, and so on. So roughly speaking, the process of radiation therapy planning is to gather a bunch of data. Typically, we work off of images, X-ray CT images or magnetic resonance images, sometimes positron emission tomography images, much less usually ultrasound. The general approach means, really, are we going to use X-rays or are we going to use electrons? Here at the University of Washington, we also have a neutron therapy machine, which generates a proton beam that's similar to the electrons. The protons hit a target, in that case, a beryllium slug that's about that big, and by nuclear interaction, produce neutrons. The neutrons then can be used, and there's some biological advantage for some tumors of doing that. We're one of only 2 operating neutron facilities in the entire U.S. There's only about 3 more throughout the world. So we have a variety of ways to go. And then, as I mentioned, there are these computer simulation programs, of which we've built a few here. Some of them are commercially available products. Most all of the commercially available products that have been popular over the years have been traceable to university research and development projects that became commercialized. We actually did that ourselves with our first and second systems, but it was such an awful experience that the PRISM, I decided not getting into it this time. Now, it's possible with the simulation system to create a radiation therapy plan that geometrically looks great, but you can't actually do it because the machine would have to, top head of the machine would have to smash into the patient's torso in order to treat something from below. And so there's feasibility issues, and the programs typically don't deal with that. You have to kind of look at what you're doing directly. So I want to say a little bit about PRISM. This is sort of a commercial break. But when we built the third system, I decided we're not going to go with a commercial technology transfer. And the whole PRISM source code is available on the website here at the Radiation Oncology Department. And it's licensed under the LISP, Lesser GNU Public License, so anybody can use it. However, its purpose is for research. And the reason why I say that is these systems, these radiation therapy planning systems, were declared by the FDA in early 1970s, to be medical devices, and therefore subject to regulation. So that in order to sell or distribute a medical device, just as with drugs, you have to get approval from the FDA. And so they review medical devices, and they you have to fill out a certification, go through a certification process, which is number 510K, and the FDA reviews your manufacturing processes and standards, your testing processes and everything, documentation and so on, and then they give you the okay to distribute. And this applies to anything, that any medical device that's distributed, whether it's free or not free, so you can't even make your own system and then distribute it. What you can do is you can make up your own software and you can use it. So what medical doctors do in their own clinics is not regulated by the FDA. And so we have no problem using PRISM or any of its predecessors in the clinic. We don't have to get regulated or approved.
How much modification would another user have to make on PRISM in order to use it as their own?
None. So one of the things that's really important is when you design these systems, there's all this machine-specific information. So there are these different companies that manufacture different radiation machinery. And what you have to do is make, so the medical physicist's job is to make a bunch of measurements on the machines that they have in their department. Even from the same manufacturer, the machines are not exactly the same beam profiles and the same intensities and so on, you're given machine settings. So the medical physicist has to make a bunch of measurements. Then they take all those measurements and put them into tables that go into the computer program, and the computer program does the calculations and modeling based on that. So the program itself doesn't require any changes to go from one place to another. The medical physicist's job is to then is to take the program and put in their local data, and then it operates off of that. Yeah. And so this is called commissioning. And it takes typically 2 months to do all the measurements for one of those radiation treatment machines and put it all into the system and get it and verify that everything's calculating correctly. So what you have to do is you have to do calculations with the system, and then you do measurements on what we call phantoms. A phantom is a bunch of plastic, metal, water, other kinds of stuff all constructed together to simulate some part of a human body. Excuse me. And so we put dosimeters, little plastic scintillators or other kinds of measuring devices into the phantom in little holes that are designed for them. And we actually run the radiation treatment that we've just calculated. And then we compare what the dosimeters measure with what the program has produced. And that gives us an idea of how accurately the formulas model the radiation machine. Now there's a separate question. I'm assuming that's what you're asking about. There's a separate question. Is the program actually calculating the formulas that the programmer claimed he implemented or she implemented? And that has nothing to do with measurements. But if you have some mathematical formulas and the program is purported to implement those formulas, there are two things you can do to try to verify that. One thing you can do is actually have somebody systematically read through the source code and verify by hand that the program, line by line, actually corresponds to elements of the formula. And we did that. And the other thing you can do is you can construct test cases whose calculation results can be computed by hand rather than measured. And so the test results that can be computed by hand, we know exactly what the computer program should do. It should give exactly the same result out to as many decimal places as you can generate. And so we actually did that too. We generated a whole suite of test cases for different situations. Now, this is only sampling. So even though we have maybe 100 or 200 test cases, and we run them all, that's only that's an infinitesimally small sample of the possible treatments you could model. And so it really just gives you some assurance, some confidence in the program, and sometimes you can catch errors that way and correct them, but it does not guarantee that the program is correct. So proving that programs are correct is a hard process, and the hand inspection of the source code is the closest that anyone has come in the case of these programs. In some other cases, there's a possibility of automating the checking of the program to see that it does the calculation we claim it does. But that's a whole other topic for another talk. Okay, so we had the idea of kind of investigating all of those questions, and and we can talk about that another time, but we certainly wanted to model good software engineering practice and provide a chance to innovate new ideas in software. And of course, then you have to go and look into these automated testing methods. So Prism is a little bit unusual in that it's written in Lisp, which is a not commonly used programming language, but it turned out it was really the best possible way to go. It has its roots in artificial intelligence, but Prism is not an AI program. It turns out that Lisp is really good for very high-level abstraction, for writing programs that are about ideas and concepts and relationships, which is largely what modeling the human body is about. And many people contributed to the Prism project as well. And this, as I said, was an international project. Witold Palaszczynski was a graduate student in computer science who came from Poland and is now back in Poland on the faculty at the University of Wrocław. Dora Avitan is from Ben-Gurion University in Israel, where there's a medical center and a setup very much like the University of Washington. And Prism was first used clinically there as well as here. And so there were kind of parallel implementations, and they did a lot of testing for us there. So now we look at the clinical target volume project itself. So diagrammatically, this is how we kind of think of tumors. There's a gross tumor volume. That's the shaded area. Gross tumor volume means just that. It's gross. It's what you can see on the images, or what you can feel by examining the patient. Oftentimes it's possible to examine the patient. You can actually feel the extent of a lump. But it's really what's easily determined to be by visible means or by other means. But we know that's not the whole story. So what happens is that tumor cells leave the solid mass of the gross tumor volume and they spread out through the surrounding area. And sometimes we see that lymph nodes become enlarged, and they're actually palpable too. But involved lymph nodes, whether they're palpable or not, they are part of an extended volume we call the clinical target volume. And it's called the target volume because it tells us really where to aim the radiation beams. It's called the clinical target volume because it's really about stuff that you mostly can't see or feel. And so it's rare that there are palpable lymph nodes, but there are. It's very common for lymph nodes to have tumor cells in them, and you need to treat them. And then the question is how far to go. And then, of course, there's another problem associated with that, which is that when you treat radiation therapy patients, there is a extended period of time that they're on the table, usually about 10 to 15 minutes, throughout which you're changing the direction of the radiation machinery. And there's problems of keeping the patient still during that time so that the tumor volume doesn't slide around. And anyway, they have to breathe. So in particular in lung cancers, when we treat lung tumors, the tumor itself moves whether you try to prevent it or not. You don't really want to try to prevent it. So accounting for that means we really actually aim at a somewhat larger volume called the planning target volume. Many years ago, we figured out how to compute the transition from the clinical target volume to the planning target volume with a simple set of rules, with the idea that how much extra you allow around the clinical target volume really depends on how the patient is immobilized, where the tumor is, and so we know something about the mobility of tumors. And that all was possible to identify and encode, but we didn't know how to get from the gross tumor volume to the clinical target volume. And that's what we're looking at now, what we've been looking at. Now, that drawing is very simple, but in fact, the clinical target volume can be pretty complicated. And let's see, maybe get the lights, not all the lights, but yes, perfect. I mean, you can keep the back lights on, that's great. So the blue, light blue peeking through here is kind of the gross tumor volume. And there's some rendering errors here which don't cover it completely. But the red is, roughly speaking, what the oncologist, the radiation oncologist, thinks is the clinical target volume. That's what the radiation oncologist thinks is where the tumor cells are likely to have gone, given that this is the location of the primary. And you can see that it's quite extensive and it's complicated in shape. And that's because it depends a lot on really how tumor cells migrate throughout the body. And generally, most tumor cells migrate throughout the body by getting into the lymphatic system. There are other methods, other ways as well. But if we had a model of the lymphatic system, a connectivity model of the lymphatic system, and we had a location for the tumor, presumably we could say, okay, here's the tumor, here's the lymphatic drainage paths, and we could just follow all the paths and we would know where the cells went. So that was the question. We started working on this in the mid-1990s. Here's a more realistic diagrammatic rendering of sort of lymphatic chains and nodes. And the idea here is to just introduce some terminology for you. So here's lymph nodes C, B, A, and D. And the arrows indicate the usual direction of flow. And so in a sense, we could say B and C are upstream from A, and D is downstream from A. And in the FMA and in anatomy, you have two terms which refer to these upstream and downstream relationships. The terms are efferent to and afferent to, or afferent to. And if a node is efferent to another node, that means that node is downstream. So we can say A is efferent to D. Honor, I've got this right, you've got to check me.
Yeah?
Okay. So if I ask, what's efferent to A, I'll get the downstream nodes, in this case, just D. But if I ask what's afferent to or efferent to A, I'll get B and C, which are upstream. And it turns out that thanks to Onard and others, the FMA has this information in it. So if I have a tumor here, somewhere in the sinus cavities, and I have a specific anatomic location, the FMA can tell me these lymphatic chains are the drainage of that area or that organ or anatomic entity. And then I can say, well, what's downstream from them by looking up the efferent to relationship. And it'll tell me this one's efferent to that one and so on and so on. And I can keep recursively querying and generate paths. So the fact that the foundational model of anatomy has this logic representation, which has all the connectivity, makes it very powerful. And now I want to pause and just say a little bit about terminology systems. So medical terminology systems are also ubiquitous. There are very large examples. In a medical terminology system, typically the organizational structure is by classification. And so this goes back, I think, to the part of biology where people were very concerned to group things together in some way according to structure or function or whatever. But the idea that something is a more general class and something is a more specific example of that or a subclass. So class-subclass relationships dominated people's thinking as they built terminology to describe biological entities. In the FMA, there's much more than just classes and subclasses. So particular kinds of lymphatic chains are subclasses of the general class lymphatic chain and inherit the properties of lymphatic chains in general. But what we're really interested in isn't what's a subclass. We're really interested in what's upstream and downstream. And there are many other such relationships. So that makes it really fabulous. So essentially, this is our theory. The computational procedure is, starting from the tumor location, you do just what I said, look up the lymphatic drainage paths from the FMA. And for each path, then once you've got a complete path, you go down the path and you compute probabilities that the cells will go from one lymphatic chain to the next, because we know as you get further down the lymphatic chain pathway, the probability of a further downstream node having tumor cells in it will be lower in general than upstream. And we can represent that in terms of transitions and probability. And then we group the lymph nodes together. And this is an unfortunate artifact of the way radiologists and radiation oncologists think about the head and neck and other areas. They kind of group things together in terms of nodal regions. And so then we have to aggregate all of those probabilities into regions in order to be able to compare the predictions with reported literature, because reported literature talks in terms of groups of nodes and chains, not in terms of individuals. Now, that may change, and in the future, surgeons may be labeling more specifically what they take out, and the pathologist can then report out on individual smaller units, and then a model like this would be tremendous. So now I have to say a little bit more about the FMA. Essentially, as I said, it's a description of structural entities and relationships throughout the body, starting from subcellular all the way up to body parts, organ systems, and the entire body itself. The most central part of it is the anatomical taxonomy, which is both a classification hierarchy and all the relationships among the different entities. There is an anatomical structural abstraction, which is really a kind of theory of part-whole relationships and other spatial relationships. And if you look up literature, you'll see that a lot of work has been done on the part of idea, because just to say that something is part of something else doesn't work. There are different kinds of parts. They have to be rendered in the right way, because having spatial or regional composition of parts is one thing, but being constituents in the sense of muscles are, for example, made up of different layers and different kinds of tissues, and in turn made of different kinds of cells, those are kind of constituent parts, and we have to render all of those, and so the FMA does that. There was in the original conception the idea of an anatomical transformation abstraction, which would look at embryology and development, organism development, and I don't know what the status of this is. I think it's still kind of something we dream of, right? But it's an idea that
we're going in that direction.
Yeah, we're hoping to be able to do it. One related thing to this is that in addition to the FMA itself, which is primarily human anatomy, there have been a number of anatomical ontologies built for other organisms and mappings between them. So this is a kind of step in that direction. You have to be able to map ontologies and have them be able to evolve through some transformation. And of course, there are the other thing that distinguishes the FMA is the foundational principles that govern it, the rules, the definitions, and the FMA is very strict about how the modeling takes place and what kinds of things you can say, and that makes it computationally reliable. I can't emphasize that enough. Without having a computationally reliable structure, there's no use in making any kind of theoretical models. And so it really stands apart from some other efforts to build ontologies, which really are terminology systems with much less discipline. And while at first people built these things without thinking they would need discipline, I think some have come around now. A good example is the gene ontology, which originally didn't have the kind of principles and strict composition rules that the FMA had, but people have recognized that the gene ontology idea is something that really has power if they can clean it up. So that's in the works. And here's an example of how the lymphatics are rendered in terms of relationships, and this somewhat reflects, these are, what would we say, regional parts. So this really is a kind of description of the thoracic duct tree and its components. And we're not going to be looking at that so much. We're going to be actually looking at the specific downstream relationships. So these numbers are old. I'm not sure, maybe Jim or Onar, do you have an
it's
idea?
It's about 85,000 classes, 150,000 terms, 178 relationship, 2.5 million.
So all the numbers are now bigger. So I think this is about 5 years ago. Now, here's where the rubber hits the road. Some brilliant person created a network-based application programming interface by which you could query the FMA in a really simple way and get actual answers back. And this is how it looks. So you send these text strings through standard TCP/IP port, and the foundational model server returns back a similar looking structure, essentially a list with strings in it, and the strings are all the names, which are just what we need. And so the get children is the key, because get children queries the relationships in the hierarchy, and you specify which relationship. That's what hierarchy means here. And term is just which entity in the FMA you want to find out about. So it was easy to do this. You can actually try this at home, right? This still works, right?
I don't know if you can use Telnet anymore.
You're the security guy, remember?
Yes, right. So there's no security issues here, because we're just querying a knowledge base. We're not querying any private confidential data. And if you have an up-to-date Telnet server, well, it wouldn't be a Telnet server, right? It's just the port on the other end just accepts a string as input, and it returns a string as a return. Telnet is actually a very trivial program. It's about 2 pages of code, and it's in the standard networking textbooks. If you're a C programmer, you can go and read these books. You can look up the right chapter, and there's an example Telnet program. This is really simple. That's all it does. So you can actually do this by hand. You type this string, and you get back this list as the response. So it's easy enough to write a socket-based program that just makes the queries, constructs the queries, and sends them instead of you having to type them. And so we did that. We implemented getChildren as a Lisp function. And here's a Lisp program that, given a starting anatomical location or entity, will generate all of the paths, the downstream paths. It's downstream because the relationship we're looking for is the efferent to relationship. And path search, I haven't written out here, but path search is based on standard code from some of the AI, well-known AI textbooks. It's a half a page of code. So another slide would have path search in it. And it's really not a big program. It's not 150,000 lines of code. And then the general lymphatic paths program just looks for lymphatic drainage and then applies find all paths to everything that's the lymphatic drainage starting point. And here's an example of how the results you get back. So for the soft palate, we get back a bunch of paths. These two end up at the right places. This one ends up at the right place also. The right lymphatic duct and the thoracic duct, or left lymphatic duct, connect into veins. One of them goes to the right subclavian vein, and the other one goes to
left
subclavian vein. And so the lymphatics flow back into the bloodstream. By the way, if you get that far, once you flow back into the bloodstream, the show's over for radiation therapy. Now you have to do systemic therapy, because the cells are going to circulate all over the body through the bloodstream. But oftentimes they don't get that far, and that's where we're interested in the business. Now, this path, the ending is at the beginning, because we push new nodes onto the front of the list. So this one ends at the jugular lymphatic trunk, and we found this where what happened was the efferent to relationship was modeled at different levels in different places, and this really should be more specific. There's a right jugular lymphatic trunk, and there's a left jugular lymphatic trunk, and those have further connections downstream. But in general, you can't say, because there are two variants of this, you can't say where it goes from there unless you know, are you on the right side or the left side tree. So that's something we had to wrestle with. Here's the probability model. So the idea is that each lymphatic chain has possibility of having no tumor or having some varying amounts of tumor, and that's represented by a Markov chain with state. And we just arbitrarily picked 5 states, 0 meaning no tumor, and 1, 2, 3, and 4 being progressively more. Excuse me. And then these numbers are the transition probabilities, so we just picked some numbers. Of course, if there's no tumor, it's going to remain no tumor, unless there's a node above it. For each of the other nodes, we just decided that it was a 50-50 chance of either staying the same size or growing, which means transition to the next state. And then we had to accommodate downstream. So we said, if there's tumor in one node or chain, there's some probability that there will be an increase in the probability of being in state one because of that, and that's what these numbers represented. And so this model of progressively growing and then cells going downstream, this can all be represented in some fairly straightforward mathematical formulas.
So in that model, is there a conservation of...
Yes.
Is there a conservation,
Of probability.
Okay.
There's conservation of probability. Conservation of tumor, we did... Well, there isn't conservation of tumor. Tumors are growing. They're accumulating...
Yeah, but that's in your...
Yes, it's in the formulas. I'll show you that next. Okay, so here are the transition matrices, which are represented by capital P's, and here are the formulas. So, in general, or at least when you're in state, so K is the state, J is index, is the where you are in the path, and T is time. So at the next time, the probability of the J chain being in state K is just the transition matrix times the probability at time t. So this is just matrix multiplication, and this is a standard kind of Markov process. That is, the next state doesn't depend on anything but the current state. It doesn't depend on the history. Now, there's also this probability that something upstream will cause you to go into state one, and that's computed here. So p prime is the probability at time t plus 1 for the jth chain that it's going to get some tumor from upstream. And that's just the probability of the j minus 1 chain in the ith state times the probability of the downstream transition. That's what q is. It's the 6.6, 0.7, 0.8, and so on. And so for k equals 0 and k equals 1, we have a slightly different formula than upstairs. We have the transition term from the matrix. And for state 1, we have this added bit. And of course, for state 0, we have to subtract. So that when you add up all the probabilities of being in any state for any chain, these all add up to 1. So that's where we conserve probability. And here are the Q's. And here are the regions that we kind of grouped everything together with. And I'm going to kind of skip quickly through the rest so we have a few minutes to talk about this. So what we did was we had some residents draw these standard regions, region 1, 2, 3, and 4, and so on images. But we had, essentially we were creating a standard atlas. And what we wanted to do then was to be able to map the standard atlas into a specific patient. And it's pretty different between patients. Here's an example of the regions that are defined. And the mapping essentially used deformable registration. And the deformable registration is pretty well established. Criteria for finding the best fit parameters is essentially minimizing the entropy between the two image sets. And we got pretty far with it. But there's a lot more work to be done. So it looks like this could work. There is some work that needs to be done on the Markov model because we don't account for tumors leaving the mass in any particular chain, which actually might cause a decrease in tumor size. That is, you could get back from state 2 to state 1. We have no way to do that. We just have to change the transition matrix to do that. But we haven't experimented with it yet. And similarly, there's some phenomena where when people do the surgery, they find that tumors have skipped nodes. And there are uninvolved nodes, and then downstream there are involved nodes. So that meant that there was a transition back from state 1 to state 0. So by modifying the transition matrix, we should be able to accommodate that without changing the basic model. So the next steps involve getting a lot more data, our own data, and refining the model and running it and trying to see how well it can match up. And then ultimately, we would take all of this machinery and incorporate it into a treatment planning system like PRISM and evaluate its clinical efficacy. And you know, some years from now, maybe we would be better able to target tumors and increase the chances of success without morbidity. So that's those are the directions in which we're going. And there are only a few publications. The most recent one was some auditing work we had done. That was where we discovered the problem with the jugular lymphatic trunk, and then it's also described in a book I wrote a couple years ago. So there's lots of people involved, and hopefully lots more people involved. There's been a lot of support from the National Library of Medicine for the FMA and for my work, for our research training grant and a publication grant for the book. I have to put a little commercial in for John McCarthy, who's retired now from Stanford, but still involved in writing and interesting character. And thanks. And can we stay another few minutes? I guess they, so thank you. We're open for questions.
Yes. Ira, you mentioned that when you initially picked the transition probabilities for the Markov model, it sounded like it was a bit arbitrary. Have
yes.
you had a chance to refine those probabilities based on data yet?
One thing that we did, this was done by a summer undergraduate student, Monica Yuen, did some work on experimenting with the robustness of the probabilities and to see what would happen if we ran them all up or ran them all down. And just sort of systematic tests of running the model and then seeing how it compared with the original choices. What it did was it demonstrated that there seems to be a pretty smooth relationship between the choice of probability or a set of choices of probability and the outputs. So running them up gave a little bit over prediction of, in most cases, of the downstream nodes. And running it down gave a little bit of an under-prediction. So we know that it's pretty, the model is smooth. And it looked like our initial choice was pretty optimal relative to the small amount of surgical data we compared with. But there's more that needs to be done. Okay.
Have you looked at the other types of cancers?
No, this has mainly been head and neck cancers, mainly squamous cell carcinomas, which are pretty common. But it certainly could be applied to breast cancer, to prostate cancer. We just didn't get to that yet. And again, there's not much, so you have to have detailed surgical data against which to compare the model output, because we are predicting levels of detail that people never had before. And most of the papers you'll see published really just address very gross questions like, should we treat the nodes or not? You treat the lower neck or the upper neck. It's pretty gross. And so a lot of the data that are reported are aggregate data. You can't really tease them apart to compare with the model. So that'll be hard. Head and neck actually has probably more detailed reporting of data than most other sites. Yeah.
I'd like to point out that your use of, and the FMA's use of efferent and afferent are really contrary to the FMA's organizational principles, because those are functional, they're flows, they're processes, whereas the FMA should be just stuff you can see in a snapshot. Let me go on.
Something to be said about that.
Yeah, so same with nerve conduction. Nerves can conduct both ways. These vessels can flow both ways. It
yes,
has to do with the pressure. The pressures at the ends of the vessels.
Absolutely right. And in fact, radiation oncologists tell me they have observed cases where it appears that tumor cells get lodged in nodes, and there's a substantial amount of growth, and then there's blockage, and then there's actually backflow.
Right.
And it spills over into a joint.
Okay. Maybe that part.
And that mucks up the whole calculation.
Okay. So that, and I'm trying now, working very hard to understand how to represent processing. So, the process of tumor of lymph flow.
Yeah.
Would, if you had an instance of that process, it would have as a participant the lymph itself as the thing that flows.
Yes.
It would have a source, which could be one node, and a sink that's
the
other node,
right.
And then a conduit, which would be the lymph vessel.
Right.
So I'm just curious, and I think the answer is no, but I'm just curious, can you see any advantage to taking that implicit process, that's implicit in afferent, efferent, and making it explicit as a process flow model?
Yeah, that would be a way to handle this problem of backup and spill it. I mean, that mm-hmm. things go in other directions. And so, yeah, I think that would be a really interesting direction to pursue.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
I just want to make sure, from the point of view of the radiation treatment planner, what you would end up with this thing is it more precisely defined with clinical target volume, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that is the problem. So right now we have radiation treatment machines that can do very sharp edge. They can create very sharp edge treatment volumes where you get a high dose gradient. You get 60 gray in some area here, and it drops very precipitously down to 20 or even 15 gray or 10 gray, like in 2-3 millimeters. And so there's this tremendous opportunity. People are all excited about this. We now have optimization programs which, given the target volume and a definition of the other volumes around of organs and structures you don't want to over-irradiate, the optimization program can figure out intensity patterns for the different radiation beams and can create oftentimes a really good approximation to the desired dose distribution. But if you don't actually know what that clinical target volume is, you're doing all this calculation, you're doing all this precision, and you could completely fail.
So then you would test the effectiveness by seeing how well the patient did over the time, or how would you?
Yes, you would. So what you would do is this is a hard problem. I mean, clinically, because you have to follow patients yeah. for years. What you would do is you'd have to look at for patients treated with the more precise target volumes. In any case, what we want to do is we want to follow patients, and we want to know for patients who have recurrence, essentially treatment failure, where did the recurrence occur? And we would track that and correlate that with the target volume.
That's longer than an NLN 3-year grant.
Yes. I mean, that would be a National Cancer Institute 10-year project. And there's an unfortunate history to this, which is the history of technology in radiation therapy planning and radiation therapy is that nobody ever does clinical trials with this stuff. It's not considered necessary or desirable because when new technology arises, people just see that it's so terrific, it's great, you know, we've got to just adopt it. They don't actually ask these questions. And if I were to write a grant proposal today to evaluate the efficacy of such a thing like this, people would just throw it away. They'd give it a score of 7 or 8. Which is pretty terrible. No, there is.
Oh,
new scale is 1 to 9. So 9 is the worst.
You are the
Yeah. No, I'm on one of the TV boards, so yeah. Okay, another question. Okay,
thanks. You.